Amateur Radio Newsline report number 1863 with a release date of April 26, 2013 to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. Ham radio rallies to assist in the wake of a killer quake that hits China. Another loss in the ongoing fight against BPL. A number of new hamsats are now on orbit. The latest news on Hamvention 2013. A new D-Star repeater where few might expect it. And a new book to interest the new ham and non-ham alike. All this and more on Amateur Radio Newsline report number 1863, coming your way right now.
From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's first and only independent on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now, reporting from near Houston, Texas, here is Skeeter Nash, N5ASH.
Amateur radio was there to provide emergency relief communications after a powerful earthquake killed more than 200 people and injured several thousand in China's rural southwest on Saturday, April 20th. Graham Kemp, VK4BB of the WIA News, has more.
Fa Bin, Bravo Alpha 1 Romeo Bravo, reported that amateur radio operators swung into action to provide emergency communications and coordinate part of the disaster response. Fan Bin, VA1RB, has recently reported that public communication was back to normal in the disaster area and the local repeater systems continued to work well. He said that the Chinese Radio Sports Association, also known as the Chinese Radio Amateur Club, no longer required emergency communication frequencies. It expressed thanks for the support from IARU member societies and others. A role for some radio hams was maintaining traffic control with emergency supplies arriving, including tents, water, food and medicine. Neighbouring Russia sent rescue teams, and the Red Cross from Hong Kong with an embedded radio amateur are helping the ongoing effort.
For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Graham Kemp, VK4BB of the WIA News in Australia.
5 years ago, a massive quake hit the same area. The 2008 disaster killed tens of thousands and left some 5 million people homeless. Back here in the United States, word that the FCC rejected an appeal from the ARRL and has upheld its current broadband over power line rules. In denying the ARRL appeal, the FCC said that the league had raised no new arguments nor proved that previous FCC BPL-related decisions contained mistakes. The FCC went on to say that its previous decisions regarding BPL strike what it calls the right balance between the need to provide access broadband over power line technology while protecting incumbent radio services against harmful interference. In a related story on the ARRL website, ARRL Chief Executive Officer Dave Summer, K1ZZ, said that he wasn't surprised at the decision. However, he also noted that some of the rhetoric used by the agency in continuing to defend what he termed as its wrong-headed promotion of the flawed BPL technology is disappointing. The twice-delayed maiden flight of the Orbital Sciences Corporation's Antares rocket carrying three CubeSats with amateur radio payloads has been called an overwhelming success, as we hear from Amateur Radio Newsline's Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, in the newsroom with the details.
After a pair of delays due to technical and weather-related problems, the Antares rocket lunged skyward at 5 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Sunday afternoon, April 21st, this from the launch pad at the NASA's Wallops Island, Virginia flight facility. On board were three ham radio CubeSats, dubbed phone sats, because they were built using off-the-shelf smartphones. All three of the PhoneSat-based CubeSats carry an amateur radio payload downlinking on 437.425 MHz. Each CubeSat will transmit during individual time slots using AFSK modulation at 1200 bits per second, AX25 packet coding, and have vertical linear polarization. The two PhoneSat 1.0 satellites, codenamed Graham and Bell, transmit with a period respectively of 28 seconds and 30 seconds each. The PhoneSat 2.0 beta satellite, Alexander, transmits with a period of 25 seconds. All of the tiny birds are using the call sign KJ6KRW. The PhoneSat webpage at www.phonesat.org provides access to the dashboard, allowing hams to track the location of the satellites in real time. detailed information on the downlink packet telemetry format can also be found on this page as well. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF. I'm in the newsroom in Los Angeles.
The orbit of the PhoneSat satellites is very low, and they are expected to only remain on orbit for 2 weeks. The satellites are battery-powered with no additional charging from solar cells or any other source. The OSSI-1 CubeSat and three other satellites were launched to orbit from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan on Friday, April 19th. Also on board the Soyuz 2-1A launch vehicle were some research and commercial satellites. Korean artist Ho-Jun Song, DS-1 SBO, has spent 7 years developing his open-source satellite initiative satellite that he named OSSI-1. He has designed and built it from scratch using readily available components rather than expensive space-qualified hardware. The launch reportedly cost him a cool $100,000 and is believed to be the first one-person privately constructed and launched ham radio bird. We will have more ham radio space-related news later on in this week's Amateur Radio Newsline report. Neither the federal government nor any Massachusetts state agency or the Boston Police ordered a shutdown of cellular telephone service in the Boston area following the terrorist bombing of the Boston Marathon on Monday, April 15th. The systems simply failed of their own accord because of too many people trying to use them at the same time. Amateur Radio Newsline's Norm Seeley, KI7UP, explains.
On April 18th, outgoing FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski said the FCC would follow up on cellular service issues at the Boston Marathon. This while emphasizing that broadband services had not been shut down after the bombings. Genachowski conceded that the event again raised issues of communications and public safety, like those the FCC has been working on for some time. However, he went on to acknowledge that wireless networks were so overwhelmed by the temporary surge in traffic that there were incorrect media reports that mobile services had actually shut down when they had not been. What appears to be a fact is that most cellular subscribers erroneously believe that the phone in their pocket should function perfectly 100% of the time. The reality is that no cellular system currently in use can handle 100% of all its subscribers at any one time, or even 50% for that matter. Most experts say that when most cell phone systems reach between 15 and 20% of its subscribers simultaneously using the service, that it is at a point of limited network density. In other words, it can't handle any more subscribers more until those online hang up. And that's what appears to have happened in Boston after the two bombs at the marathon's finish line went off. It's also why the autonomous Boston Marathon ham radio communications networks continue to function flawlessly even when the cell phones failed. For Amateur Radio Newsline, Norm Seeley, KI7UP in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Genachowski said that the FCC will certainly pursue this issue along with other agencies. He called it an institutional imperative for the FCC. Meantime, an excellent reference guide on what you can really expect from your cell phone, including in emergency situations, has been published online by the FCC. You can find it on the web at tinyurl.com/cellphone-reality. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, heard on bulletin stations around the world, including the KB5 ELV repeater serving Erie, Pennsylvania. Emergency Alert System expert Richard Rudman, W6TIA, says initial feedback from the Boston area indicates emergency officials did not use the EAS to issue shelter-in-place warnings when authorities were looking for the bombing suspect. According to Rudman, if reports from the greater Boston area show that EAS was not used to issue the shelter-in-place warning, it's time for the entire emergency management community to take to heart and put into practice FEMA's still new protocol known as the Integrated Public Alert and Warning System, or I-pause. If you happen to know for certain whether or not Boston officials did or did not utilize the emergency alert system for public notifications in the aftermath of the Marathon bombings or to issue the shelter-in-place order, please let us know. We, in turn, will be happy to pass along the information to W6TIA. More on this story is online at tinyurl.com/Boston-EAS-alerts. The FCC has adopted rules requiring that emergency information provided in video programming be made accessible to individuals who are blind or visually impaired. It's also mandating that certain apparatus be capable of delivering video description and emergency information to these citizens. Specifically, the rules clarify that the new emergency information requirements apply to video programming provided by entities that are already covered by Section 79.2 of the Commission's rules, along with any other distributor of video programming for residential reception that delivers such programming directly to the home and is subject to the jurisdiction of the Commission. The complete text in PDF format is online at tinyurl.com/emergency-alerts-4-the-blind. Two businesses have been told that they will have to pay some heavy-duty fines for importing and using cell phone jamming devices. Amateur Radio Newsline Stephen Kinford, N8WB, reports.
On April 9th, the FCC issued a notice of apparent liability in the amount of $144,000 to the Supply Room in Oxford, Alabama. On the same day, a $126,000 NAL was imposed on Taylor Oilfield Manufacturing in Brossard, Louisiana. In both cases, the FCC received anonymous tips that cell phone jamming was occurring at both businesses. Using direction finding, FCC agents discovered strong wideband emissions in the cellular bands that they determined to be one or more signal jammers at each site. On inspection, both the Supply Room and Taylor Oilfield Manufacturing admitted to the agents that they had each purchased a number of cell phone signal jammers off of the Internet from overseas sources. And here's where it really gets interesting. Not only did each business freely admit to purchasing and using the cell phone jammers, but their excuses were interesting as well. In the case of the Supply Room, its general manager admitted that the jammers were in place to prevent its employees from using their cellular phones while working. Not only that, but that the devices had been in operation for more than 2 years before they were caught. Meantime, managers at Taylor Oilfield Manufacturing told FCC that the devices were also being utilized to prevent its employees from using their cellular phones while working, but in this case following a near-miss industrial accident, one that the company alleges was partially attributable to employees' cell phone use. While both companies voluntarily surrendered their jammers to the FCC, that did not help mitigate the penalties that have been imposed. In fact, the FCC told both companies that they must submit payment in full by May 9th or file a written appeal. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Stephen Kinford, N8WB, in Wadsworth, Ohio.
Both businesses were also directed by the FCC to file a statement to be signed under penalty of perjury no later than May 9th, that would provide the source or sources from where each purchased or received the jamming devices. The FCC has issued an official citation to Ruben D. Lopez Jr. of Pomona Park, Florida. This for operating an incidental radiator and causing harmful interference in violation of Section 15.5, paragraph B, of the Commission's rules. In this case, the incidental radiator was, of all things, a well pump that was putting out a signal at 1800 kilohertz and interfering with ham radio operations. On July 15, 2010 and February 28, 2011, in response to complaints of interference to amateur radio service reception of medium and high frequency radio signals, the Enforcement Bureau issued Lopez two letters informing him of the complaints. The letters summarized the relevant rules, instructed him to resolve any interference, and suggested he install new AC line filters for his well pump. On October 23, 2012, in response to another complaint of interference to amateur radio service reception, agents from the Commission's Tampa Office of the Enforcement Bureau used direction-finding techniques to identify Lopez's well pump as the source of transmissions on the frequency 1800 kilohertz. The agents confirmed that Mr. Lopez's well pump was the source of the interference by conducting on-off tests. The interference ceased when the well pump was turned off. At that time, the agents informed Lopez that he must cease operating his well pump until the interference could be resolved. After the October 23, 2012 inspection, the Tampa office received information that Lopez tried to eliminate the interference by replacing the AC line filter for the well pump, but the new filter did not resolve the interference. Now, in its April 23rd citation, the FCC has instructed Lopez to take immediate steps to come into compliance by repairing or replacing his incidental radiator and eliminating all harmful interference. It also directed Lopez to confirm within 30 calendar days after the release date of the citation that he has ceased operating his incidental radiator or taken steps to eliminate all harmful interference. If he fails to do so, the FCC says that he could be subject to substantial monetary penalties, seizure of the offending equipment, and criminal sanctions. The entire text of the citation is online as a PDF file at tinyurl.com/pump-QRM. Some names in the news. Tony Bond, EI9GMB, says he is again operating Radio Foxtrot 100. Foxtrot 100 is an internet radio station dedicated to ham radio and shortwave listeners that has topics related to ham radio in addition to its music programming. More is on the web at foxtrot100.weebly, that's spelled W-E-E-B-L-Y.com. Outgoing FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski will likely become a fellow at the Washington, D.C.-based Aspen Institute when he steps down from his current position. The move makes Genachowski the fifth former FCC chairman in a row to become a senior fellow of the Institute, following Kevin Martin, Michael Powell, William Kennard, and Reed Hunt. The Aspen Institute is an international nonprofit organization founded in 1950 and dedicated to fostering enlightened leadership, the appreciation of timeless ideas and values, and open-minded dialogue on contemporary issues. The 18th VHF Week Signal Group dinner is set for Friday evening, May 17th, at the Dayton Grand Hotel in Dayton, Ohio. This concurrent with the 2013 Dayton Hamvention. The cash bar opens at 6:15 p.m., with dinner to be served at approximately 7:15 p.m. This year's guest banquet speaker is VHF contester Jeff Klein, K1TEO. Reservations are required, and seating is limited to 125. Tickets are $40 per person from Tony Emanuel, WA8RJF, 7156 Corey Court, that's spelled K-O-R-Y, Concord Township, Ohio, 44077. For more information, contact WA8RJF@ARRL.net. DSTARinfo.com and the Georgia DSTAR Group will again conduct training for beginning and intermediate DSTAR users during 2013 Dayton Hamvention. The three-hour instruction will be held Friday, May 17th at the Drury Inn Ballroom, conveniently located in the Hamvention Hotel area at 6616 Miller Lane. The class will begin promptly at 8 a.m. This training will provide the basics for new DSTAR users, guiding them through the registration process, getting on the air, and how to get the most out of handhelds or mobiles. Class size is limited, and pre-registration is required at tinyurl.com/d-star-class. The cost of the class is $15, and attendees will receive all course materials. For more information, please email info@dstarinfo.com. This is Ham Radio News for today's Radio Amateur. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, with links to the world from our only official website at arnewsline.org and being relayed by the volunteer services of the following radio amateur. D-Star is bringing some unexpected places to the VHF and UHF bands. This with word that the first repeater using this mode has come on the air in the Canary Islands. Amateur Radio Newsline's Heather MB, KB3TZD, has the details on this one.
Sponsored by Radio Club Vicendario, the ED8ZAB D-Star machine is located on the island of Gran Canaria at an altitude of about 4,000 feet above average terrain, covering most of the group's seven islands. The system currently runs 10 watts out on 438.4625 MHz and listens for signals on its input that is 7.6 MHz below. It has been reported as having been heard by stations in both Portugal and Spain during two recent tropospheric openings, a distance of more than 1,400 kilometers. And for those who are not world travelers or DXers, the Canary Islands are a Spanish archipelago located just off the northwest coast of mainland Africa, 100 kilometers west of the border between Morocco and the Western Sahara. They are one of Spain's 17 autonomous communities and an outermost region of the European Union. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Heather Emby, KB3TZD in Berwick, Pennsylvania.
If by any chance you happen to hear the ED8ZAB D-Star machine outside of its local coverage area, please send a report by email to ED8ZAB@yahoo.es. South Africa AMSAT will hold its annual Space Symposium on Saturday, May 18th. The venue is the Innovation Hub in the city of Pretoria, with McLean Sibanda, the CEO of the hub, as its keynote speaker. The symposium is sponsored by South Africa Telecom and features an agenda that is packed with interesting presentations and demonstrations. Full details and the registration form are available on the web at www.amsatsa.org.za. A web-based, software-defined radio for the 5, 7, and 14 MHz bands is now available on the new Radio Society of Great Britain website. The Web SDR receiver link can be found under the My RSGB drop-down menu. Also on the new site are Live DX Cluster and Live Solar Data pages under the News drop-down menu. Go to rsgb.org for more. The final results of the 2012 New York QSO party have been published. You can read them online by taking your web browser to rdxa.com/results/2012. This year's plaque winners will be receiving the awards in the mail as soon as they are completed. Participants can also download and print their own paper awards and participation certificates, or have the New York QSO party print them for you. The latter requires a $3 donation sent via PayPal to af2k@juno.com. Please include your name, call sign, and mailing address with any online orders. On the air, VUCC grid hunters who need Canadian Grid EO40UD may want to listen for WB8BZK/VE3, who will be on the air from Sesaganga Lake in Ontario Province between May 26th and the 31st. He will be operating only on 6 meters, primarily on 50.135 MHz, running SSB and CW only. Operating times are tentatively each morning at 12:30 UTC, and then again between 22:30 and 2300 UTC each evening. If you make contact, please QSL with a self-addressed stamped envelope to WB8BZK at his address on QRZ.com. The special event call PD13MILL will be on the air May 10th to the 12th in honor of the Dutch Windmill and Water Pump Weekend. Operators will be PD5JFK, PD0ME, and PD7BZ, and they will have three stations active at the same time on 40, 20, and 10 meters using SSB and the digital modes. A 2-meter station for local contacts will be operational as well. QSL via PD7BZ, direct, via the Bureau, or electronically on Logbook of the World or EQSL. Information about Mills on the Air is on the web at pd6mill.com. In DX, a multinational, multi-operator DXpedition to Vientiane, Laos is being planned for September 6th to the 16th. They plan to operate five stations from 160 to 6 meters using CW, SSB, and RTTY. A website is currently under construction and will be available soon. The call sign and more details will be announced later. The Malaysian Special Expedition Team, operating as 9M2SE, will be activating Perhentian Besar Island from May 1st to the 3rd. The group will use a pair of 100-watt transceivers on 40 through 10 meters, running CW, SSB, and some digital modes. For QSL information, please check 9M2SE carefully on QRZ.com. VU2PAI and W4VKU are on the air from Bodu Finolu Island as 8Q7KP through April 30th. Their operation is using two stations on the various high-frequency bands. QSL electronically via OQRS, EQSL, or Logbook of the World. DL6JGN and DL2AWG should be operational as ZK3N from Nakanonu Atoll until April 30th. Modes being used are CW, SSB, and RTTY. This one counts as OC-048 for the Islands on the Air Award. QSL is directed on the air. Lastly, M0HLT will soon be off to the Falkland Islands on a 2-year work contract. Arrangements have been made to acquire a VP8 call sign, and he will be operating from VP8LP when work commitments allow. QSL via his home call. And finally, this week, the story of a new book for new and potential hams. Amateur Radio Newsline's Cheryl Lassick, K9BIK, tells us all about it.
Riding the Short Waves, Exploring the Magic of Amateur Radio, is a new book by author Don Keith, N4KC, that contains material of special interest to newcomers to ham radio and those thinking of joining its ranks. This includes easy-to-understand chapters on antennas, choosing a first station, and a tour of the amateur radio high-frequency bands. There are also short fictional and satirical pieces that use humor or drama to show the various facets of the hobby. According to Keith, that's why he took the approach that he did.
I felt there was a need for a book for people who are just on the verge of either committing to ham radio or walking away from it. So I had to think about what's keeping people from entering the hobby. What would it take to kind of push them over the cliff?
Keith also notes that it's just a matter of being in the right place at the right time and in the right situation for ham radio to become part of someone's life.
That was my case. My dad was not a ham. He was a television repairman. He had a shortwave receiver, and we used to sit around and listen to the hams and listen to Sputnik and all sorts of stuff like that, and the bug bit.
Keith's book also counters the notion that Facebook, the web, Twitter, smartphones, and other new technology have made amateur radio obsolete. On the contrary, the author maintains in its 100th year, the hobby is more vibrant and exciting than ever. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Cheryl Essek, K9BIK, in Zion, Illinois.
Riding the Short Waves, Exploring the Magic of Amateur Radio, is available in both paper and electronic release from booksellers everywhere, including Amazon.com. You can hear more from Don Keith, N4KC, talking about this new book and his other writings on this week's Rain Report. Just take your web browser to therainreport.com and tune in. With thanks to Allen Labs, AMSAT, the ARRL, the CGC Communicator, CQ Magazine, the FCC, the Ohio Penn DX Bulletin, Radio Netherlands, RAIN, the RSGB, the Southgate News, Twit TV, and Australia's WIA News, that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline. Our email address is newsline@arnewsline.org. More information is available at Amateur Radio Newsline's only official website, located at arnewsline.org. You can also write to us or support us at Amateur Radio Newsline, 28197 Robin Avenue, Santa Clarita, California, 91350. A reminder that the nominating period for the 2013 Amateur Radio Newsline Young Ham of the Year Award is now open. Full details and a nominating form are on our website at arnewsline.org/YHOTY. For now, with Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, at the editor's desk, I'm Skeeter Nash, N5ASH, near Houston, Texas, saying 7-3, and we thank you for listening. Amateur Radio Newsline is copyright 2013, all rights reserved.